So the title of the talk is The Inquisitive Mind, and slightly adapted today, Freedom, Thinking and Awakening. I was just getting really interested in the role of thoughts and thinking in the spiritual process. So I did quite a bit of research and thinking and reflecting on it and collated a number of thoughts in particular areas. So what I'm hoping to talk about tonight is something about awareness of thoughts in general, and about thinking, reflection and contemplation. And I'm also going to talk a bit about what you could call the perceptual situation, like how thinking arises, the theory of the Buddha, how thinking comes into being. And then I'm going to talk a bit about something that's called Dharma Vichaya, which means Dharma inquiry, which is a kind of it's an investigation of the mind. And something about concepts, quite a lot actually. I'm going to say something about concepts and finishing off with something about the nature of thought. So it's quite a wide scope of topics within this thinking area and inquiry area. And I'd also like to start by saying that actually, maybe a bit of a funny start, that thinking is probably highly overrated, especially in Western society. I do think that there is a huge bias towards the information that is processed in the head, and we are forgetting that there is a lot of neurological activity going on in the spine, in the belly, in the gut. There's so many other ways to receive information than via the brain and via the thinking brain. And I think, especially because we're in a society that's packed with information and very much sort of kind of information that we sort of taking in through mobile devices, internet, so there's all kinds of stuff coming through in this area here. So I think for a lot of us it means that we're probably not paying enough attention to the information that comes through, you know, the heart or the guts, which you get a lot of information from if you'd be receptive to that. So I just wanted to say that. And on the other hand, I also think that I'd just like to say that there is, I think, a bit of a misunderstanding about thinking and thoughts in meditation, which I come across time and again. There is this assumption that it's a bad thing to have thoughts in a meditation. So something about thoughts coming up in the meditation, and then want to get rid of the thoughts. I don't want these thoughts shouldn't be there. Because meditation should be a space where there aren't any thoughts. Well, actually, I think for most of us, that is just not like that at all, because we do have a mind, we've got a brain, thoughts will just arise because we've got the faculty, and the faculty creates thoughts. So what I'd like to get to a space where we get more appreciation of the role thoughts can play in the meditation and in the Dharma investigation, so in the working with the mind on the spiritual path. So, and also personally just saying that I love this Dharma inquiry. I just love to explore what's coming up in the mind and apply the Dharma to it. And now and again, I just make a big discovery in meditation, on a retreat, or sometimes just sitting on a train, just really understanding something so much more deeply that it just alters the course of my life, and it alters the course of my life for the better. And that's why I love it so much. It's this faculty that you are using to investigate your experience. But I'll say much more about that later in the talk. So firstly, I'd like to say something about awareness of thought. And because I think maybe most of you agree that we all have a lot of thoughts all the time, but having thoughts and being aware of a thought is a huge difference there. whether you're actually aware of the thoughts, because I think most of the time the thoughts will just come, but there's no mindfulness of them. And especially in Buddhism, it's vital that there is some awareness of thought, because all actions start with a thought. If there's a thought, action will follow, and action has an effect, action has an impact on other people, on yourself. So ethical conduct, it starts with awareness of thoughts, really. So there's that. So there is that is just really, really important in Buddhism, that there is more, that you establish more mindfulness of thought somehow. But also another observation I'd like to make is that you can't really change the thoughts that are coming, the thoughts that are coming up, but you can change your relationship with them. So you can change the relationship with the thoughts rather than the thought themselves. So there's two different things. You've got the thought coming up, which is more like a, you just come up as a result of all kinds of conditions, and is that how you respond to it? So there's the relationship that you could change. You can do a lot about that with practice, Buddhist practice. And so these are just a few loose ideas that I've had about awareness of thought in general. For instance, I think it's also, it could be quite helpful if you start to, if you haven't done that already, I think you probably, each of you who have a meditation practice probably do this to a certain extent, is that in the meditation that you, that when the thoughts come, that you're kind of understanding what category of thoughts they are. So, you know, you might have the planning thoughts, or you might have the thoughts, sort of the thoughts about the past, or you might have the thoughts about work. So it's just ever so helpful if you start to see that a bit more, like what kind of categories of thoughts are visiting you most, as it were, are you having most. You just learn from that. And also, something that I'm finding quite interesting is you can actually learn from the speed of the thoughts. So you could safely say that if there's a lot of thoughts, yeah, if there's a lot of thoughts coming up, that there is some sort of unhelpful, you could say, mental state underlying them. And if the thoughts are a bit more kind of quiet and a bit more slow, there's probably some sort of more kind of positive mental state underlying it. So that in itself is an interesting exploration. So if you're meditating, you're noticing the thoughts, it's like, how often do the thoughts come? And if they're churning wildly, if there's a lot of them, you just probably, it's like a signal to start looking at the emotional content of that's underlying the thoughts. As it were, you can kind of then say, okay, there's a lot of thoughts, there must be some sort of emotion going on. Well, these are just a few approaches, the way you could work with awareness of thoughts. So thoughts can indicate particular mental states. And it would be really interesting to see what type of thoughts are coming up. So that's my bit about the awareness of thoughts. So I've got something about thinking and reflection and possibly contemplation. And so I think I've said that just now, is that having thoughts is very different from thinking, if you see what I mean. So thoughts will just come, but thinking is a deliberate process. And thinking is actually that you've got a particular direction and a particular focus and a particular mindfulness in the thoughts, if you see what I mean. You're kind of directing the thoughts. And Sangharakshita, who is the founder of Trudhatma, most of you might know, got quite a few ideas about this topic. And he, for instance, says that thinking is the way to improve the capacity for thought. He's saying that thinking is the way to improve the capacity for thought. And also, he puts a lot of emphasis on training the thinking faculty, because it helps so much to get more clarity in what's going on in the mind. So he really thinks that's that is important. And actually, He, for instance, says that an hour actually should match all the time. Every time you spend an hour on meditation, you should actually match that up with an hour on reflection or thinking. Well, I think there's probably an ideal world when we can actually do that, when we have enough time in our life. But it just says something about creating a space for the thinking faculty to exercise the thinking faculty, and how important that is. Because it just seems like, especially if you're thinking about one of those topics of the Buddhist teachings, for instance, somehow what it seems to do in the mind, it really calms the mind down. And I sometimes think about this in, do you know, like the mandala? Have you ever heard of this word mandala? It's an arrangement in a circle, and it's all arranged around that whatever is placed in the middle. And so if you start to reflect on one of those Dharma topics, for instance, on impermanence, for instance, or there is suffering, one of those famous teachings of the Buddha, it just seems like you just bring your mind back again and again to a topic like that. It just quiets the mind down, and it seems to rearrange things somewhat in that moment, and it just brings more clarity to the mind in that moment somehow. So you could use, for instance, writing as well to clarify your thinking, or make a mind map, or that kind of method, just to exercise that thinking faculty. So that is quite important. And for me personally, I think you might be able to identify times when your thinking faculty seems to work best. And my personally, for instance, taking a shower, I don't know what it does, but it really sharpens my thinking. So I do make quite a lot of discoveries. Or sitting on the train, for me, sitting on the public transport, for me, it just really focuses my thinking. So you might have a particular activity like that that you could just really use to exercise that thinking quality. And just as a last thing about this topic is that so you've got thinking, you start thinking around a particular topic, and it turns into reflection. And reflection, it's a bit like when we're doing the mindfulness of breathing, what you're putting in, what the focus is the breath, isn't it? So in reflection, the focus would be whatever you're focusing on. So the teaching itself would become the focus. And then you call it a reflection. But in that process of reflecting, the more concentration can come about, and you can start to be much more, go much more deeply into the thoughts. And then it turns into contemplation. And you're not too far away then from meditation, if you see what I mean. It's like a kind of in-between state. So in the contemplation, you're really using the thinking, but there's a lot of clarity and calm as well, if you see what I mean. Does that make sense so far? Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, if you're not, that's always a good sign. So now something about the perceptual situation. And I don't know how many of you have you heard of this word prapancha? Some of you might have heard of it. Lots of lots of good. And I can start afresh. So prapancha is, I think most of you will have heard of the Wheel of Life, yes? Yes, a lot of nods here. So in the Wheel of Life, there is also, it's a symbolic representation of conditionality, how conditionality works in the mind, how it makes it go round and round and round. There is a variation of this, and particularly in a sutta that's called the Honeyball Sutta, and it's really well explained, I think, is that, I'll just try to explain it as clearly as I can. So, on the basis of having senses, so you've got an eye, you've got eyes, you've got nose, ear, tongue, body, and the sixth sense in Buddhism is actually the mind. And so just suppose, let's just take one of those senses. Let's take the eye sense. So you've got eye, and in Buddhism then it says you've got eye consciousness. And eye consciousness you've got eye consciousness and there is an object. I look at you, I know you're my object, you see what I mean? So there is an object and there is eye consciousness, and on basis of that, there is contact. Yeah, so that's just a term that the Buddha gives for that meeting of eye consciousness and object together that forms contact. So contact, according to the Buddha, has a feeling tone. That's what the tradition says. It has a feeling tone. So contact could be either pleasant or unpleasant or slightly neutral. It could be very unpleasant or very, very pleasant or just neutral. It's a sliding kind of scale. There's all kinds of it's that beautiful quality that we have that you can sense. Yeah? So there is now, at the moment, there is some, the touch sense, there's some cold air on my skin. And for me, the feeling tone is unpleasant. Sorry. I'll use this example again because it's a good illustration of how this whole process works. So you got this feeling tone, which is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And on the basis of this combination, you get the contact, you got the feeling tone. There is something that you call samnya, which is perception. It's like a label, a recognition. So there is a label, and I instantly gave you the label, it's the cold air. And I can know it's the whole cold air coming out of the air conditioning as well. So there is something, the label is cold air, in this case, yeah? So on the basis of that, arises thinking. So thinking starts to arise. So what starts to arise is, there's this cold air, it's slightly unpleasant. There's this air conditioning happening. Oh, did we do the right thing? Getting this air conditioning, buying this? Are other people suffering from this horrible cold wind? And on the basis of thought arises what you call prapancha. So I've made this observation, there's the airco is probably blowing a bit cold, and then this whole chain of thought starts to arise. There's all these stories that you fabricate based on this really simple sense data fact. You see what I mean? And this is what the Buddha says, is this is like the main cause for suffering in human beings, is that somehow we take a whole load of stuff to this perceptual situation and start to knit and fabricate whole stories out of it that have nothing to do whatsoever with reality and what's going on, and kind of take you away from the present and take you away from, create some sort of dream state, if this makes sense at all. So the opposite of that would be like totally awake and totally aware of all these, the fact that there's all these raw sense data coming in, and just being with that. Okay, this is extremely unpleasant, maybe. Something might be extremely unpleasant, but you could just leave it at that. You would not kind of start to push it away. Or something could be extremely pleasant, and you're not trying to grasp it and hold on to it and hope it's not going to go away. So it's just much more kind of in reality, in how the flow of how reality unfolds, because there's so much happening all the time. And that choice that's made, I was doing this workshop at the Buddha Food Festival where I was over the weekend on Sunday, and we were talking about this topic, because the workshop was on the topic of prapancha, and there was all these noises going on, lots of noises, you had people, children, people shouting, and music, and this, that, and the other, and there was one woman who said that she felt that the bass tone of a particular of the music was unpleasant. So out of this whole field of sounds, I asked them to concentrate on sounds. Out of all these sounds, she chose this particular bass sound that she found unpleasant. So the choice of what you're concentrating on is totally conditioned. Mm-hmm. Totally conditioned by everything that's gone before, if you see what I mean. So the Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's a Buddhist monk, a writer, he's quite good, I think. I really admire him. He's done a lot of good work on the topic of translating suttas and Buddhist psychology, Abhidhamma. So he has this definition of prapancha, which appeals to me. I'll read it out, and I'll read it out twice because I think probably needs reading out twice. So he says, the primary problem to which the term prapancha points is the propensity of the worldling's imagination to erupt in an effusion of mental commentary that obscures the bare data of recognition. I'll say that again. Yeah. So he says, the primary problem to which the term prapancha points is the propensity of the worldling's imagination to erupt in an effusion of mental commentary that obscures the bare data of recognition. And I think it's a very sort of interesting way of saying, I hope what I've been explaining before, I hope that's clear now, that phrase that he uses. So the mind is somehow prejudiced in the way it sees and perceives things, and often starts on this track of fabricating a story. And I think most of you might have heard this phrase of in the seen only the seen, in the heard only the heard. You see it all over. What is it, often mentioned in the Pali Canon? It's the Buddha emphasizing again and again how important it is to go back to these bare sense data. So to go back to a body, go back to awareness, go back to what's actually happening, rather than what you've added on to it, as it were. And I think sometimes it's also known as the first and the second arrow. That's probably some people might have heard of that, so the teaching of the first and the second arrow. So the first arrow would be that bare sense data, and the second arrow is all the stuff that you pile onto it yourself. So the I was saying earlier how sometimes in the course of my life, at least, some sort of seeing something more clearly has led to so much more happiness. And that was, for me, this was a retreat I was on maybe 14 years ago or so, I can't remember, that I was doing this meditation of being aware of body and being aware of feeling. And then in that, when I was meditating, this is like a longer meditation retreat, I was doing lots of meditation, I was feeling some sort of sensation in my stomach, and it was quite unpleasant. And then, because my mind was much clearer, I started to see how, I started to formulate this whole fantasy. I saw myself, I thought, oh no, I'm getting ill, I'm getting really ill, I'm getting so ill, they need to phone an ambulance, and there's going to be an ambulance, I'm going to be carried in the ambulance on the stretcher, and then I've got to interrupt my retreat, and everybody will be upset, and there is this whole stuff going on. It all came out of this single sensation in my stomach, unpleasant sensation in my stomach. And because I saw it so clearly in that moment, I could get rid of, I mean, I still got loads and loads and loads of prapancha, but I've got it much less than I had before. I saw it so clearly, it kind of, just seeing it so clearly, got rid of a load of the prapancha that was happening in my experience before I saw it so clearly. So just saying that's the kind of thing that I think is really important. It's really important to look at the mind and to look what's happening, and to apply what you know about the Dharma to what you see. So that's the... I didn't know it was called prapancha at the time. I only found out years later. That brings me to my next topic, which is called Dharma Vichaya, which the literal translation of that would be Dharma Investigation. And the Dharma Investigation... officially, it's part of the seven factors of enlightenment. First you get mindfulness, and then you get this Dharma investigation, and then you get energy, and then you go up on the spiral with rapture, tata, the whole thing. And I just wanted to be clear at this point that I'm not talking about moments of seeing as this big sort of awakening with a big A, and like now we're enlightened. I'm talking about all these moments, smaller moments, you know, of really seeing something that you've not been seeing before. Yeah. So I just wanted to make clear that that's what I'm talking about here. So if there is a bit more mindfulness in the mind, if the mind's not caught up in all kinds of hindrances and there is a bit more mindfulness, you can start to look more clearly at what's going on. It's not always possible, but sometimes it's possible when you're meditating that the mind gets a bit clearer and you can start doing this stuff and you can actually get some really interesting results with it. So this Dhamma Vijaya comes out of some more mindfulness that's present in the mind. And it's twofold really. So it's an inquiry into the nature of experience. So and also at what you're doing at the same time is correlating that with the teachings of the Buddha. So what you're actually doing is you're taking some sort of dharmic framework, like one of those teachings, like this is impermanence or there is suffering. You're taking that concept and you're applying that to look at your experience. I don't know whether that makes sense. So it's a bit like, I'm going to talk a bit about concepts later, but it's a bit like you've got a map. It's a bit like, I was thinking the other day, it's a bit like, you know, you've got Google Maps and then you switch into Google Earth. It's not like you're really seeing things as they are with Google Earth, but that kind of shift. So you've got the map, which is a representation of reality. It's not actual reality. And then you've got what's actually happening. You see the difference? So the map would be the teaching of the Buddha, and what things really look like is the nature of reality. Does that make sense? So it's like the teaching of the Buddha would be like a pointer. So it points to something, and it can't ever be it the thing itself, if you see what I mean. It is always a pointer. It's always a pointer. So, and the Buddha and nobody else can actually tell you what you see when what you see when it's been pointed out. You've got to do the seeing yourself, but you can use the pointer. So this Dharma inquiry is that you're using the pointers, you're trying to look into the nature of reality, and sometimes that pointer just can drop away and you actually see it for a bit. Does that make sense? Okay. So the very basic way of doing this Dharma Vijaya thing is that an easily accessible thing would be to, if mental states coming up in the mind or in the experience, that you could make this distinction, skillful or unskillful. I have to unpack a bit, but I think with a bit of logic and a bit of sense, you know, just common sense, you could figure out how sometimes an emotion that is happening is not really conducive to happiness. And sometimes there is an emotion and you know, it's compassion, it's some sort of openness that is conducive to happiness, if you see what I mean. It's fairly easy to make, instinctively, to make that distinction with an emotional state that's coming up. Not always possible, but most of the time it's fairly straightforward. And it's not said that you should get rid of that, whatever it is that's coming up, but more like you're just, you'd still have a very friendly, welcoming attitude, whatever is coming up in the mind, but you could gently sort of make that distinction. Is there something that I'd like to perpetuate, or is there something that I'd not like to perpetuate? And there is something there that is really, really vital, I think, because on the basis of that, you could start to work with whatever is there. Because if you do see, okay, this is not something that I would like to perpetuate, and if I think about it, I don't think this quality is bringing a lot of happiness and openness in my life, you might be able to, you get more energy to start applying Buddhist practice to that, like more mindfulness, or you could do metta, or I'm going into that a bit more a bit later, if you see what I mean. I hope this is a clear thing, I'm not sure. But that's the simplest way of doing this, this Dharma inquiry. So just another thing I'd like to say about this is that recently I was sitting in our garden in West Hampstead, which has got the rail, the Thames Link rail, just right behind it. So you've got a lot of sound from the platform, which I'm quite used to. But I was sitting in the garden under our apple tree, just wanting to have a bit of space and a bit of green and relaxing a bit. And then I heard somebody somewhere practicing a guitar, you know, Sunday afternoon practicing a guitar. And somehow, don't ask me why, I just got really, really annoyed and irritated at the fact that there was somebody playing the guitar. And but what then happened is I started to get really curious. I started to get really curious as to why I'm just sitting here minding my own business, and now I start to get really, really irritated. So what is going on? So I just started to look a bit more deeply into my experience, and so I do think that sometimes this quality of looking and maybe sometimes seeing, sometimes some healing needs to happen because there's been some pain in the past and it just needs to be acknowledged or seen or acknowledged basically or accepted. So I from my past when I was living with my parents, my sister would practice her music instruments, and this is maybe a bit personal to record, I don't know, but she was seduced by her music teacher basically, and then we had this, you know, it was really, really difficult, it was so difficult, you know, the whole atmosphere at home, and it came out, and it was just and she completely upset, my parents being upset, everybody, you know, it was a really difficult time, and somehow just that I had brought that sort of some sort of pain to the listening to somebody practicing a musical instrument. So, and just seeing that that is what I brought to that experience kind of cleared it up. And I was staying at the Buddhafield Festival next to the musicians, and during the weekend they were constantly practicing their instruments, and I didn't experience any irritation whatsoever. So just, I just thought it was an interesting example of how you sometimes, you just so, there's so much conditioning that you bring to a perceptual situation that it's got nothing to do with the here and the now, nothing to do with the person who's playing the guitar, but you do bring it to that situation. And it caused in me, of course, this very, sort of the sound had a very, very unpleasant sort of vein, and then I started to kind of get into all these thoughts about it. So, but the thing about it is that I think, if I hadn't done some of this inquiry or even known about negative mental states or had the intention to work with negative states, I don't think I would go down the path of exploring the anger or the irritation. So that is somehow, if you just start to get curious about the emotion and you start curious about your experience, it takes the fuel away somehow. It's just quite magical how that happens. So instead of being completely entangled, because I think negative emotion does do that, you get completely entangled, like maybe like even cocooned in it, you know, you can like a bit like woo woo, yeah? It completely captures you. So if you then can remember, okay, what I can do some inquiry here, I can start looking into my experience. If you remember that, that's the difficult thing, really. If you remember that in the moment that you got this big emotion that's holding you in the grip, then that will start leading you into a different direction. And then the anger is probably going to subside quite a bit or lose its power. And you get more clarity and you just go down a different path. And it also, I think, then that in itself decreases the suffering, because one, the anger doesn't have the big hold on you that is quite unpleasant, that causes you suffering, and two, if you hadn't been noticing it or inquiring into it, it might spill over, so you might kind of get just set you up for a whole day of miserable experience, or it spills over in speech. You might meet someone, you're still irritated, and that kind of translates, and you get into kind of some sort of horrible spat with someone. That's sort of how it sort of seems to happen. Things just spilling over into the next experience. So, it's just an example of how I think Dharma inquiry can be really, really helpful. So bringing this curiosity and interest to your experience. So I wanted to say something about that concept. And, you know, I was talking about these pointers, which you could call concept. You could say, like, a teaching could be concept. But concept is obviously a word that's quite widely used. And this is in itself, I think, quite interesting. In each of you, probably, when I use the word concept, something starts to unfold, or you get connotations, you bring whatever, your personal experience, to this word, even, yeah, the word concept. And I just wanted to, or just say, let's say the word Africa, which is a concept. Everybody has got different relationship with that word. So you might start to think, okay, yeah, Ratnaprabha is now in South Africa, and maybe he's seen some lions or whatever. Or you could think about, oh my God, what's happening there? There's this war here, or there's this. You see what I mean? There is this word South Africa that for everyone opens up a whole different realm of connotations. And also, if you would just, okay, there is this understanding that there is this continent called Africa, but in reality, there isn't a fixed thing called Africa, because if you look at it at the map, you look at it like with a, you know, with a satellite or whatever, and you turn your head away and you look again, it's completely changed somehow. You know, the outline has changed somewhat. It's not a fixed thing. It's constantly shifting and changing. So I just say that because I think we sometimes think that a concept has some sort of intrinsic truth value, if you see what I mean. But it is not like that. So all these concepts are actually completely fluid, and they don't have any sharp edges, if you see what I mean. Yeah, so they're all pointers. They're pointing to some sort of reality that we call Africa, but for each of us that's different. And there isn't an independent thing called Africa, if you see what I mean. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's something about there is a fluidity. Some you need to probably, if you can, but I don't think we can do that most of the time, is just hold these concepts with some sort of fluidity, with not grasped onto them, but kind of hold them lightly. And Buddhism uses these concepts to point to reality, but it was never meant to be theoretical. The Buddha never meant this to be theoretical. It was always meant to point at some sort of direct experience. So the Buddha would always encourage people to look into their own experience and apply these teachings to their own reality. Just really understand them on their own level, understand them deeply on their own level. So, and in Buddhism, it's often used as the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, as some sort of raft. So you've got the stream, you've got the raft, and you get on the raft and you cross the stream, and when you cross the stream, you don't need it anymore, yeah? You don't need your raft anymore. So that is in itself every concept, you could see like that. You're using it to get to the other side, and then you lose it. You're not going to carry it on your back when you're on dry land. But at the same time, it's also important to know that you can't just jump from one side to another, so you do need the concept. There's nothing wrong with concepts. So the teachings, the set of the teachings of the Buddha are seen as a positive set of concepts, so you can use them to your advantage, but they don't hold any absolute truth, if that makes sense. So they're like a map of reality, but you've got to see it for yourself. So, and Sangharakshita's got something to say about this.
Yeah.
He says, it's true that transcendental insight itself is independent of conceptual thought, but it just doesn't appear out of nowhere. It arises on the basis of the conceptual expression of the Dharma. It's on the basis of thinking about the concept of impermanence, say, that you develop insight into the truth of impermanence. Intellectual understanding comes first. It's a sort of a springboard. Yeah. I thought there was a neat quote. So, and then it's just not always easy to recognize the difference between what's theory and what's direct experience, and you just can't explain it either. Nobody can tell you. I think it's just something you know. You just know. You can't say more about it. You just know it. I can't say more about it. You just know. Yeah. So, lastly, in my list of topics, I wanted to say something about the nature of thoughts. So we have talked about awareness of thoughts and investigating the mind, the Dharma inquiry. And there's another way of investigating thoughts is if you can identify one thought, a single thought, a separate thought. It's very difficult because the thought's actually never really separate from anything. It just kind of comes out of nowhere and it goes back into nowhere. It's not like it's ever got like any kind of fixed identity anyway. But it's quite interesting to, if you can understand that intellectually, but you can maybe understand it more deeply if you start to explore these thoughts in terms of like, what kind of shape? Has it got a shape? Has it got a colour? So you could just apply that to your thoughts, and then I think you can see more deeply that there isn't any colour, there isn't any shape, there is nothing there, actually. It's quite interesting, that. So, and this is also something that is quite painful, that we have a thought and we totally believe it. We just totally believe it. It's like they're solid, made of rock. You got this thought. You look at something, somebody, you got a thought and you totally believe in it. It's actually, if you really think about it, it's a bit insane, but we're doing it all the time. Yeah, we're doing it all the time. Total, this total faith in our thoughts, that they're solid and they're based on something and they're completely true. So that's another thing you could do. Just don't believe your thoughts so much. It's a difficult thing to do, but yeah, just knowing it might help. So there is somebody in the Buddhist tradition called Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. He's actually on the there's this picture on the shrine that's got Sangharakshita's teachers on it, and he's one of them. And I really find his writing really clear. And he's especially about the nature of reality. I think he's extremely clear. So I'll just give you two quotes from his writings on this topic of the nature of thoughts. He says, "Once you recognize the intrinsic nature of mind, these thoughts that seem to appear and disappear all the time can no longer fool you. Just as clouds form, last for a while, and then dissolve back into the empty sky, so deluded thoughts arise, remain for a while, and then vanish in the emptiness of mind. In reality, nothing at all has happened." And he's got another image, which I quite like. "When sunlight falls on the crystal, lights of all colours of the rainbow appear, yet they have no substance that you can grasp. Likewise, all thoughts in their infinite variety, like devotion, compassion, harmfulness, desire, are utterly without substance. This is the mind of the Buddha," he says. So maybe we don't have the mind of the Buddha, possibly, yet. But we can certainly practice and have these moments of clear seeing. And sometimes we can, I think, allow thoughts just to dissolve by themselves. You call that self-liberating. So you can have them self-liberate. So there's a thought coming up. You just don't respond to it. It's just a thought. It's just coming up and then disappearing again. That's like that process you could call self-liberating thoughts. So these thoughts, sometimes if we can, if we're really relaxed and we've got some clarity and some openness, these thoughts can just dissolve by themselves. And then we don't meddle with them and don't add anything to them. And we don't interpret them in an unhelpful way either. So, and also what he is saying, Dilgo Khyentse again, "They will cross your mind as a bird crosses the sky without leaving any trace." I really like that image again. It's also in Dogen. Dogen has got the same kind of image where you've got this bird crossing the sky. You look again, it's nothing. Beautiful image. So there's one way is to see that insubstantiality of thoughts directly, if you can. But I do think you need quite a lot of clarity around that and calm. So, but you're not most of the time, I guess, when we're just, you know, living our lives, etc. If you can't do that, it's there's so many other things that you could still do. And so any kind of instrument that we come across on the path will contribute to more clarity and will create more conditions to sing more clearly. So for instance, some studying or reflection will help. But body awareness, the thing about in the scene, only the scene, if there's more body awareness, it's just easier to not be led away by all kinds of a whirl of thoughts, fabrication of thoughts, if there's more body awareness. And that is a fairly simple thing to do, just bringing the mind back to the body. If it's deeply involved in something else, just bringing it back to the body somehow, bringing it back to the breath. And also, meditation is obvious, isn't it? It's really, really obvious. Meditation would help. And ethical conduct will help somehow as well. Because often, I don't know about you, but if you had a bit of an argument with somebody, there's such a lot of churning, such a lot of unclarity in the mind caused by all the thoughts that... Blah, 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 blah. So that, if just for instance, paying more attention to speech would really help, just create more clarity. But you're just working towards sowing the seeds of more clarity in the future, as it were, if you see what I mean, if you're doing that. And also in the spiritual friendship, just talking about what's going on in your thoughts and your process with someone who can contextualize that who understands what you're on about. Yeah. So I think that's kind of all I've got to say about this, really. So I think just because of this, all of these methods, all of these instruments will contribute to more clarity and more calm and more... direct experience, which will mean that you're more able to be in the present and to be transparent and genuine, all this stuff that you're probably striving for, like myself, I don't know. So that's all I've got to say tonight about this topic. Thank you very much.